We have Dr. Gary Long with us. Dr. Gary Long, there we are. Dr. Gary Long with us. I was telling him beforehand, I really deeply appreciate his ministry. I enjoy history, I enjoy biographies, and I particularly enjoy the ones that he gives us because it's stuff that no one else is doing. Last time we heard of Isaac McCoy, and many of you have said since that you've not heard of him before and you enjoyed hearing it, and now this evening we'll hear of William Knibb, another lesser known but fascinating figure, and we're looking forward to his ministry.
One of the things they probably don't tell you, you can bring your own linens and towels, but you need to bring a pocket full of money because they got this bookstore right between where you eat and where you hear it. Some wonderful books out there. By the way, I want to tell you about one here. Here's what somebody said that you know and who's been one of our speakers. Jim Eliff wrote this. Years ago, I picked up a beautifully bound old copy of the book, The Lives of the Three Mrs. Judson, in a used bookstore. For some time, it remained on my bookshelf as a prized but unread volume. I'll never forget the day that my wife and I first opened and read from this book together. We were both immediately melted to tears, sensing that we have really known very little of sacrifice for the King. Read this book together as couples, if possible, and expect your tears to flow and your devotion to increase. Jim Eliff. The book is $24, hardbound, The Three Mrs. Judsons, and we've added a little something to it from the original, completely retyped it, reset it. We've added about 24 pictures and documents in it, but no discount, sorry about that, it's $24. We're still struggling, and so your donation is almost like a ministry, a gift to a ministry as well. I would share with you that I've had two momentous events in my life that I really regard as very special from the Lord. Two gifts. One of them was to stand in the pulpit of Clarksonville Baptist Church in Clarksonville, Jamaica, and preach there on the anniversary of June 13th, 1993, which was the 200th anniversary of when William Carey left England for India. And I told the people there in Clarksonville that day, I said, here's a wonderful anniversary. Nobody's celebrating it today, but you are here and you are free because of what happened 200 years ago. That began the modern missionary movement. That was one of them. The second one was then to be invited back to Andersontown, Jamaica, and to preach the sermon of dedication for the building that our church had helped, we were involved in building a building in Andersontown. And to be able to preach that dedication was an honor beyond description. And I just, I'm humbled to even be involved with such great work that the Lord has done. Well, our subject this evening, as already been said, is a man by the name of William Knibb. There's very little written on him today. But let me start by telling you, it was June the 11th, was a typical muggy day in beautiful Montego Bay on the island of Jamaica. Though late in the afternoon, I had but one request from my host, Pastor Hubert Hall, and that was, since we were going through Falmouth, to stop and visit a grave that I had read was at Falmouth Baptist Church. So it occurred under a warm Jamaican sun that I paid my respects at a grave of one of our greatest Baptist heroes. The engraving atop the stone cover read, "The grave of William Knibb and Mary, his wife." Yet who today has ever heard of William Knibb or know how the Lord so wondrously used him? More than 100 years ago, the Baptist Missionary Society held its centenary celebration in different cities throughout England. At one of those meetings in London, Reverend J.G. Greenhoe introduced his subject with the following words. "It is my happy privilege to speak about a field where we have had perhaps our most complete success, not of fields like India, China, and Africa, where the gospel with all its wonderful doings has only gathered scanty fruits, and the great harvest of souls still drop perishing for want of reapers, My story is of a field where the Lord has gathered the most rich harvest safely into his garner, and our success there has been so complete, indeed, that we have practically withdrawn from it. So complete that instead of requiring missionaries, it sends out missionaries into the adjacent lands which are still lying in darkness. And I was going to say, so complete that it is very rarely brought before you now. You are almost in danger of forgetting it. But I implore you not to be guilty of such ingratitude. We cannot afford to close a source of inspiration like this. Our society ought to say, if I forget thee, O Jamaica, let my right hand forget its cunning. Let my tongue cleave to the roof of my mouth. Today, Jamaica is known for romantic beaches, tropical fruits, and Olympic sprinters. This small island, roughly 150 miles long and 50 miles wide, lies 90 miles south of Cuba. Let me stop and say, just in passing, Jamaica, when you go to Jamaica, you'll find the language is English. The religion is basically Protestant. Cuba, 90 miles to the north, is Spanish-speaking and is Catholic. The 90 miles difference, both of them were discovered by Christopher Columbus. Discovery Bay on the north side of Jamaica is where Columbus actually discovered Jamaica. But the difference was in the 1600s, Oliver Cromwell decided he wanted Jamaica, and he captured Jamaica from the Spanish, and therefore it became Protestant and English-speaking, for which we were very grateful when we were there. 200 years ago, Jamaica belonged to Great Britain and provided the British population with sugar. The commodity was produced by the imported African slave. What I want to share with you this evening is how the God of all providence brought Jamaican slavery to bow before the kingdom of righteousness, turning its shackles into plowshares and its chains into pruning hooks. Baptists played no small part in slavery's defeat. Much can be learned from such dedication. The institution of slavery was well entrenched in Jamaica when William Nibb was born in Kettering, England in 1803, the same year that U.S. President Thomas Jefferson signed a treaty with Napoleon for the purchase of the Louisiana Territory. Those familiar with Baptist history will recognize Nibb's birthplace as the birthplace of the modern missions movement associated with William Carey, Andrew Fuller, John Ryland Jr., and other notable Baptists. Yet on that September 7th, 1803, when William entered the world, little did his parents or his four-year older brother Thomas know the world would realize that the newborn was destined for such a momentous purpose. William and his older brother Thomas were always close. Their young lives were quite normal, and as years went by, a very intelligent Thomas was apprenticed to J.G. Fuller, son of Andrew Fuller, in the printing business. When Andrew Fuller died, they moved the printing business from Kettering to Bristol, and J.G. Fuller would not only take with him Thomas, but the young William also. In the years at Bristol, William was converted and at age 19 sought baptism. It is no coincidence that the same John Ryland Jr., who 39 years earlier immersed William Carey, now baptizes William Nibb in a peculiarly solemn and impressive service. The two early spheres of Baptist Missionary Society's work were Carey's India and Nibb's Jamaica, a providential honor that Ryland knew only in part. 23-year-old Thomas is the first Nibb to enter the missionary waters and arrives in Kingston Port, Jamaica on January the 19th, 1823. In England, William and his mother are filled with joy and pride to have their own flesh and blood serving King Jesus across the sea. Thomas is establishing himself as a diligent, effective teacher and minister when he is unexpectedly summoned eternally to appear before his king after a short ministry of only 15 months. When Mr. Fuller told William of his brother's death, his feelings were strongly excited, but immediately after the first gush of feeling had subsided, he rose from the table and said, "Then if the society will accept me, I'll go and take his place." And so it came about that 21-year-old William Nibb was baptized into the work of his dead brother. In October, William was officially designated to Jamaica. He then married his sweetheart, Mary Watkins, but before the newlyweds set sail for Jamaica, William visited his sick mother. Her dear Thomas, having been laid to rest in Kingston, and as she must now yield up another son to the cause of mission, Nib's mother rose from her sickbed and went to the window to bid farewell to William. While she held a curtain in her hand, she uttered those memorable words, "Remember, I would rather hear you have perished in the sea than that you have disgraced the cause you go to serve." Thus, on November 5th, 1824, William and Mary Nib set sail for Kingston less than 7 months after Thomas had died. And it must be remembered that when Nib arrived in Kingston in February 1825, he was designated as a school teacher and was not licensed to be a minister because he had no academic training. This proved a great hindrance to the work of the gospel. Often called on to preach and desperately needed in that capacity, he endured embarrassing court appearances because of failing to have proper documentations. Concerning this, he wrote Secretary Dyer in December of 1826. He said, "You are aware, my dear friend, that I came unprovided with the documents as a minister. When I wrote to you on the subject, you replied that it was in consequence of my not having been instructed in an academy. It is exceedingly painful to me again to obtrude this subject on your notice, but my continuance as a missionary depends in a measure upon it. I hope the society will not put me in the mortification of again appearing in open court and again being refused. I hope they will remember that here most look with a jealous eye upon us and would be glad to stop the progress of the gospel. At present, I have to supply Kingston every fortnight and Port Royal every week. I love the employment, and I have reason to hope that God smiles upon my labors. I expect to baptize in a fortnight, and it would almost break my heart to be debarred inviting sinners to Jesus, especially when thousands are perishing for lack of knowledge. May I earnestly request that you write by return of packet, and if agreeable to the society, send the documents with the Lord's Mayor's seal." And in February 1827, Nib was sent the necessary documentation to enable him to officially minister. And Baptists have always valued academic training, but have never let it interfere when God chooses to use a John Bunyan, a Christmas Evans, a C.H. Spurgeon, an Isaac McCoy, a William Nib, and on and on. God may bless that. These early years in Jamaica deepened Nib's hatred of slavery, of which he referred to in most of his correspondence back home. Many years earlier, such notables as Wilberforce, Clarkson, Buxton, and others had been successful in driving slavery from England's shores, and preceding these illustrious abolitionists, even John Milton wrote in Paradise Lost, "O miserable man, so to aspire above his brethren, to himself assuming authority usurped by God not given, he gave him only over fish and beast and fowl dominion absolute. That right we hold by his permission, but man o'er man he made not lord, such title for himself reserving, humans left from humans free." But slavery was needed if England was to dine with the sweetness of sugar. Thus, that abominable institution was left alone where economic benefit outweighed conscience. The policy of the Baptist Missionary Society was clear. Slavery was a political matter, and their missionary's task was the soul of the black man, not his stripes and abuse. Nib never violated that policy when dealing with the slaves. He loved them, hurt with them, and defended them, but was careful never to attack the institution of slavery to the slaves themselves, only to his native England and whites anywhere who would listen to his lucid description of the evils inflicted by the masters did he attack the issue of slavery. In the autumn of 1828, Nib moved to Savannah Lamar because of declining health, and then in 1830, after Reverend James Mann of Falmouth died, he was unanimously called to the Falmouth Church. While Nib is at Falmouth, events happened that will change the course of Jamaican history. In England, there is talk that Parliament is considering doing away with slavery throughout the British Empire. Jamaica planters are outraged and threaten England with the death to the slaves before they would free them. This talk in England is interpreted abroad as official, and in Jamaica, a Baptist deacon plans a sit-down strike in December of 1831 in anticipation of freedom. That strike was vigorously opposed by Nib and all the missionaries, for they knew well the possibility that a dreadful outcome would follow. So determined was Nib in his opposition to the strike, and so loud his warnings that they were being misled, that many slaves who had before trusted and revered him now began to wonder if he was a traitor to them. The strike quickly got out of hand and turned into an insurrection. A few whites were killed, crops were set ablaze, and some factories destroyed. The owner's retaliation was swift and severe, as hundreds of slaves were killed and hundreds more tortured. The planters blamed the missionaries, especially the Baptists, and within a week, Nib is arrested, verbally abused, and threatened and insulted privately and publicly. While the owners and officials mocked and abused the missionaries, their actions proved beneficial for Nib and others, for it showed the slaves, beyond all doubt, Nib was suffering with and for them. The persecution was the glue which bonded pastor and people. While Nib is in custody, a colonial church union was established under the guidance of the Established Church of England, and this union proceeded to destroy many nonconformist chapels, including Nib's chapel at Falmouth. When the news of the insurrection reached England, the blame was placed squarely on the shoulders of the Jamaican missionaries, with the Baptists bearing the brunt. The Baptists knew something had to be done, as even English Baptists would now hold their missionaries in suspicion. A resolution was passed by the Baptist missionaries in Jamaica notifying the Baptist Mission Society that one of our brethren be appointed as a deputation to proceed forthwith to England to act under the direction of the committee, and that Brother Nib, on account of his intimate acquaintance with the mission in the disturbed part of the island and his knowledge of circumstances immediately connected with the rebellion, be appointed for that purpose. So on April 26th, the William Nib family left Jamaica quietly for England. It is early June 1832 when he arrives in England and makes his way to London with much anxiety. Would the society approve of his return to England? Would they stand by and sustain their missionaries? And would they join him in trying to overthrow slavery? Private interviews prior to the Baptist Missionary Society Committee meeting were held, and the committee was united in trying to dissuade him of what he was proposing. Their policy was firm. Slavery was a political subject, not a religious one. They advocated silence on slavery, boldness on the gospel, a thought still struggled with in our own day. When the committee meeting finally was held, Nib gave a detailed account of his sufferings and those of his brethren, which was received, of course, with the deepest interest. Mr. Dyer, the secretary, exhorted to prudence and a temperate policy. At length, Nib stood up, and his words were, "Myself, my wife, and my children are entirely dependent on the Baptist mission. We have landed without a shilling and may at once be reduced to penury. But if it be necessary, I will take them by the hand and walk barefoot throughout the kingdom. But I will make known to the Christians of England that their brethren in Jamaica are suffering." Well, this affirmation had a great effect and won him many supporters. But the real question was, how would the public receive him? 2 days later, on June 21st, the annual meeting was held at Spa Fields Chapel. The first speech, unrelated to Jamaica, was delivered by the esteemed Joseph Kinghorn of Norwich. I threw that in because I just happen to have a couple of volumes out there on the life and works of Joseph Kinghorn. Mr. James Filippo, Nib's friend and fellow Jamaican missionary from Spanish Town, preceded Nib and, as prearranged, addressed the issue of expanding the society's involvement in Jamaica, leaving the slavery issue alone. Nib followed and, without hesitation, plunged into the issue with the following: "Mr. Chairman, When I inform the present numerous and respectable assembly that I stand before such an assembly for the first time, I feel persuaded that I need not say anything more to secure a favorable and candid hearing. Indeed, the painful circumstances that have forced me from my obscurity and brought me before you are so momentous, the cause I have to plead is so important, the embassy on which I am sent by my brethren missionaries is so intimately connected with the best interests of 800,000 of our suffering fellow creatures held in the chains of slavery, that an apology from me would be absurd. I deeply feel the momentous responsibility which rests upon me and which is relieved only by the cheering consideration that the avenger of the oppressed and the supporter of the innocent will sustain me. If I ever felt the sentiment of the inspired penman, out of the abundance of the heart, the mouth speaketh, it is now. His message was forceful and to the point, always building toward his goal. He spoke deliberately, but with great passion. Toward the end, he said, "But I need not say that all is lost, that our harps are hung upon the willows, and that the voice of praise is no more heard in our streets. A combined satanic effort has been made to root out all religion. The sanctuaries of God have been broken down with axes and hammers, and the infuriated yell, 'Raise it, even to the foundations thereof,' has resounded throughout the island. Feeling therefore, as I do, that the African and the Creole slave will never again enjoy the blessings of religious instruction or hear the benefits of that gospel which Christ has commanded to be preached among all nations and which he has so eminently blessed in Jamaica, unless slavery be overthrown, I now stand forward as the unflinching and undaunted advocate of immediate emancipation. I plead for liberty to worship God on behalf of 30,000 Christian slaves of the same faith as yourselves. And if the friends of mission will not hear me, I hope the God of missions will. Having in his strength entered on the noble contest, I will never cease to plead for the people I love till, aided by British Christians and by Africa's God, we wave the flag of liberty over departed colonial slavery, shouting with a melodious harmony its funeral dirge, and proclaim as we leave the spot in which we have entombed the greatest curse that has ever stained the annals of our nations, glory to God in the highest and on earth, peace, goodwill to men." Then he concludes, "And now, my fellow Christians, I appear as the feeble and unworthy advocate of 20,000 Baptists in Jamaica who have no place of worship, no Sabbath, no houses of prayer, and I firmly believe and solemnly avow my belief that by far the greater part of those 20,000 will be flogged every time they are caught praying. Among this deeply injured race, I have spent the happiest part of my life, and my spirit is there now. Would that I might under a tree or on the mountaintop invite them to Christ. I plead on behalf of my own church, where I had 980 members and 2,500 candidates for baptism, surrounded by a population of 27,000. Their prayers are put up for you. Put up your prayers for them. By prayer we have, by prayer we must, by prayer we will prevail. God is the avenger of the oppressed, and the African shall not always be forgotten. I plead on behalf of the widows and orphans, on those whose innocent blood is being shed. I plead that the constancy of the Negro may be rewarded. I plead on behalf of my brethren in Jamaica, whose hopes are fixed on this meeting. I plead on behalf of their wives and their little ones. I call upon children by the cries of the infant slave whom I saw flogged on Macclesfield Estate in Westmoreland. I call upon mothers by the tender sympathies of their nature. I call upon parents by the blood streaming back of Catherine Williams, who, with heroism that England has seldom known, preferred a dungeon to the surrender of her honor. I call upon Christians by the lacerated back of William Black, of Kings Valley, whose back a month after flogging was still not healed. I call upon you all by the sympathies of Jesus." Now at this point, Mr. Dyer, the secretary, begins to pull and tug at the tailcoat of William Nibb, wanting him to calm down. And Nibb replied vehemently, explaining,
Whatever may be the consequences, I will speak at the risk of my connection with the society and all I hold dear. I will avow this. If I fail of arousing your sympathies, I will retire from this meeting and call upon him who is made of one blood all nations that dwell upon the face of the earth. And if I die without beholding the emancipation of my brethren and sisters in Christ, then if prayer is permitted in heaven, I will fall at the feet of the Eternal, crying, Lord, open the eyes of the Christians in England to see the evil of slavery and to banish it from the earth. To say the audience was moved would be to understate such a complete and stunning victory accomplished by one man speaking for God. It was no longer a question whether or not Nibb's anti-slavery appeal would be received. Rather, the committee was now united, and slavery must be purged from all of England's domain. For the next 2 years, Nibb is sent throughout England and Scotland with the message of emancipation. Nibb's visits were everywhere eagerly sought after and eminently acceptable. His vivacity and good nature rendered him agreeable to all. His public addresses had a powerful altogether and were overwhelming. Nothing could stand before them. Skeptics were convinced. Waivers were decided. The apathetic were roused, and vast auditories were kindled to irresponsible enthusiasm. With perhaps a single exception, the eloquence of no one man made a larger or more distinguished contribution to that commanding excitement of the public mind before which British colonial slavery at length cowered and fell. In the summer of 1834, the government expressed their willingness to help in rebuilding the chapels that had been destroyed in Jamaica 2.5 years earlier. The Secretary of State proposed granting 5,510 sterling pounds if the society could raise the rest of the needed 12,390 pounds. Mr. Dyer, the society's secretary, reported this proposal on June 19th, an hour before the annual meeting was to begin. I don't think you can sense how important this was. When this announcement came, the government is going to help rebuild. What an eventful day. Within an hour, Nibb is in Spafields Chapel moving a resolution for carrying the proposal into effect. While in the next county, not far away, a baby boy is born whom the parents name Charles Haddon Spurgeon. Sacrifice, hard work, and an unwavering commitment by many persuaded England to pass laws that would give all slaves under British rule a partial freedom effective August 1st, 1834. Nibb was in England, as his Jamaicans celebrated with great joy in Falmouth, with neither riot nor even noise. Nibb returned to Jamaica in October of 1834, and upon entering Falmouth, both he and his church were overcome with emotion. The people stood and looked. It him for true, but see how him stand. Him make two of what him was when him left. Folks came from as far as 25 miles distance just to see William Nibb. Now, massa, me see enough. Him dead, him live again. God bless you, massa, for all the good you do for we. God, him too good. However, the partial freedom, known as apprenticeship, was more of the same old evil with another name. Slaves were forced to work for former masters up to 12 years and could still be tortured. In addition, this system produced its own method of pain, known as the treadmill. Because partial freedom was actually no freedom at all, the cries of those in bondage were heard, and England's conscience renewed its efforts against British colonial slavery. Nibb wrote to his Quaker friend, Joseph Sturge, in the summer of 1837 and said, "Leave no plan untried to get this abominable system down in 1838. The planters are beginning to expect and fear it, and I hope they will not be disappointed." Within 2 weeks after writing this to Mr. Sturge, Nibb buried his eldest son, William, only 12 years old. With a broken heart, he writes to Secretary Dyer, "My heavenly Father has removed my beloved William from me. Thus, in 9 short months, has my firstborn and my youngest son been taken. It is a bitter, bitter trial, but I hope that under it I have not repined. Oh, he was a lovely youth, and blessed be God. I have a good hope that he is safe in the mansions of the blessed. Then someone sent him sometime later a letter of sympathy, and he replied to that letter of sympathy. He said, "You will accept the sincere thanks of myself and Mrs. Nibb for the kind sympathy you have expressed at the loss we have sustained in the death of our beloved William. It is the heaviest stroke my Heavenly Father has ever visited me with, but it becomes me to be still and know that he is God. He was a lovely youth, just commencing, though so young, a life of usefulness, which I fondly hoped would be long continued. Only a few days before he died, he went with me into the pulpit when I said, 'My dear boy, I hope you will preach the gospel here, and when I lie under yonder tree.' Ah, little did I think that in one short week should I have to lay him under its shade. Keenly, keenly do I feel the stroke, and most earnestly do I pray that the intended benefit of such an affliction may be fully realized by myself and Mrs. Nibb." In May of 1838, apprenticeship was falling apart, and thus complete emancipation was set for August 1st, 1838. At Falmouth, on the night of July 31st, Nibb's chapel was open for worship. At a few minutes to midnight, a hush fell on the congregation, and he began to speak. This was the moment of a lifetime, the moment of all their lifetimes. His hearers were wrought up to an extraordinary pitch of excitement. He pointed to the face of the clock and said, "The hour is at hand. The monster is dying." Having heard its final note, he exclaimed, "The clock is striking," and having waited to its last note, he cried out, "The monster is dead. The Negro is free." During these few moments, the congregation had been still as death and breathless with expectation. But when the last word had been spoken, they simultaneously rose and broke into a loud and long-continued burst of exultation. "Never," says Nibb, writing to a friend, "never did I hear such a sound. The winds of freedom appeared to have been let loose. The very building shook in a strange yet sacred joy." And speeches. The next day on August 1st, after a day of religious services and many speeches, a large number of people gathered at the school playground where a grave had been dug, and William conducted a solemn burial of a coffin containing the instruments of slavery, a whip, a chain, and an iron collar. One might almost say, in the words of Mrs. Alexander, that was the grandest funeral that ever passed on earth. Does Nibb now retire a victor? Not so. He is still held in contempt by those who accepted emancipation as a bitter defeat. He continues to endure much abuse, and he endures as seeing him who is invisible. He represents freed blacks in wage negotiations. He works vigorously to bring about better relations between former slave and former owner. He led Baptists in Jamaica to start a college at Calabar, and he fulfilled his dream of seeing Jamaican blacks sent out to their homeland of Africa as free missionaries of the gospel of Christ. He would make three more trips to his homeland. His third visit to England in 1842 coincided with the Baptist Missionary Society's Jubilee, held at its birthplace in Kettering. Nibb was there and was in great demand as a speaker. He was a native son of Kettering, and second only to William Carey in the mission's roll of honor. Nibb made a fourth and last trip to England in March of 1845, returning to Jamaica on August 1st to Falmouth. He had attacks of sickness in September and October, and on November 9th, he baptized more than 40. Though he felt poorly on Monday, the 10th, he lay down much during the day, but others felt it was from such a hard day's work the day before. Tuesday, he ran errands and returned home, not to leave again. Wednesday, a physician was sent for who bled him and gave him powerful medicines. By Saturday, all knew he was crossing the river, and at 10 a.m., the struggle ended. He was 42 when he was laid to rest behind the Falmouth Baptist Church. As I stood looking upon the concrete scroll upon which his name was inscribed, I tried to imagine the great sadness that once filled that churchyard. Thousands came from all over Jamaica to pay their last respects. And when I stood there, there were thousands who were passing by every day who knew nothing of their great emancipator, nor even seemed to care. A quote from Reverend D.J. East, who was president of Calabar College in Jamaica and had gone back to England in 1892 for the centenary celebration. Here's what he said. There is one name which I should not be left, that should not be left unspoken in this great meeting. I love the name that is above every name, but there are other names that are dear to our hearts. I refer to William Nibb, the champion of Jamaica freedom, whose name is still, and I trust ever will be, an inspiration to the churches of that island. 50 years ago, the jubilee of our mission was celebrated under Nibb's auspices in the island of Jamaica. A tent as large as this was erected, and 10,000 people gathered to the celebration, and the inspiration of that gathering is still with us in that island. We cherish the name of your townsman. We honor the Master and glorify him for having given us such a champion. Much of the fruit of the church and in the college where I have had the privilege for all these years to live must be traced to the devoted labors of that lion-hearted Christian. Never let the name of William Nibb be forgotten in our missionary gatherings. And now, I'll bring this to a conclusion. We've attempted to look at some of Nibb's trials, his triumphs, his joys, his sorrow, but especially his unwavering commitment to oppose the Goliath of slavery of his day. It is difficult to see him as purely a reformer, for Nibb saw evangelism and emancipation in the same light. Like his Savior, he always sided with the oppressed, but never lost sight of the responsibility of each soul before God. He was a fierce warrior and yet a deeply spiritual man. In a letter to his wife written in 1843, he states, "Generally, I have felt a calm and humble reliance upon the great atonement mingled with the deepest abhorrence of any claim of merit. I feel and long to feel it more that salvation is all of grace. What an unspeakable mercy that the precious blood of Jesus Christ cleanseth from all sin, and that none are excluded from a full participation in the benefits it confers. I think I can say that I had rather endure sickness than commit sin, and that I do pant for more conformity to God. I know not what hope anyone can entertain from anything he has done or can do. Were it not for the atonement, I should sink into despair." He was a spiritual leader in his home, and it's reflected in a letter to his daughters, Catherine and Anne, just 7 months before he died. He said, "You have rejoiced my heart and that of your dear mother by commencing that path which, if persevered in, will lead to a seat at God's right hand. And most affectionately will I urge upon you now, in your youth, diligently to pursue your Christian race. Now is your golden time. Soon, other duties will press upon you, and other scenes engage your attention. Let me then implore you not to waste these precious hours. In prayer and in reading, as far as other duties will allow, improve them, or bitter will your reflections when too late you will feel your need of them. You have had many advantages, and your responsibilities are great. Soon, it may be very soon, your dear parents may be removed. To them, therefore, and especially to your mother, let your conduct be always such as will leave no sting when they are numbered with the dead. Your mother has had a hard and sometimes painful path to tread. Added to her maternal cares and the bitter, though salutary, pangs endured in the loss of our dear children, she has borne much of the anxiety of the stations under your father's care, and I feel her health is declining. To you is given the high privilege of preventing her every want, and teaching her by the uniform kindness of your manner how much you feel the obligations under which you are laid for her by faithful and incessant care. Providence has so ordered that you are not obliged, as I was, to leave home at an early age and seek your daily bread. I assure you, my dear girls, that I attribute most of my success in my missionary career to your excellent mother. While we are mutually impressed with the truth that we owe all to sovereign mercy and feel that we have been unprofitable servants, Especially, I feel persuaded that my dear girls will feel their filial duties pressing upon them with peculiar force during the absence of their father. The accumulated duties and increased anxieties pressing upon your mother at this period will afford you the luxury of showing how much you sympathize with her. And thus, should I be permitted to return to my dear family, the meeting will be doubly endeared to you and to us all by sweet reflections on duty performed. He said to his daughters. Now someone, we don't know who, recorded an incident that shows the energetic and determined Nib as anything but prideful. As I was returning, I heard him speaking in a suppressed voice, and I seem to hear him now, so indelibly was every sound fixed in memory. I distinctly heard the following words: O my father, suffer none of these things to draw me away from thee. Let not pride prevail. Keep me humble. Rather take me from that work which is so dear to me than suffer me by vanity to disgrace thy cause. Let me never withdraw my heart from thee to place it on the best of thy servants. These words were uttered with the earnestness almost amounting to anguish. He ceased, and after a moment's pause, I entered. I seemed to see him now. His hands covered his eyes, and tears were chasing each other down his cheeks. As soon as he heard me, he hastily wiped them away, and looking up with a sweet smile, he said, Ah, my child, these things are hard to bear. It is more than I expected, and I tremble lest they should draw my soul from God. Oh, it is much harder than it was when I entered Bristol some years ago, and almost everyone feared to be seen in my company. That drove the soul to God. Now I enter and see my name placarded in every direction in the same city, and this tempts me to forget him. Pray for me that this may never be the case. Oh, how would Satan rejoice could he tempt me to rest upon myself. Oh, my father, forbid it. Well, Mrs. P. then entered, and we began lunch. After this, some remark of commendation of him, which had been overlooked, was mentioned to him, and he said, I wish people would praise me less and pray for me more. That is what I want, that they may never have to grieve over my fall. Other similar remarks fell from him, and I think this interview produced a higher feeling of respect for his character in my mind than any public act could ever have created. I conclude by giving the last word to John Howard Hinton, his biographer. He said, Nib is now regarded as one of the greatest men of his age. But what was he? Let the reader invert this question and ask how many things he was not. He was not a man of original genius. He was not a man of lofty intellect. He was not a man of literary taste. He was not a man of finished education. He was not a man of scientific attainments. He was not a metaphysician, not a philosopher, not a poet, not even a theologian. So many things that he was not. Again, I ask, what was he? He was kind, just, firm, active, and fearless. He had good sense, strong nerves, simple speech, a warm heart, and lively piety. What commonplace qualities are these? Yet they made an extraordinary man. They made a man who, by active sympathy with its griefs, has left a world better than he found it, while too often men of genius and profundity soaring listlessly above it have, after a passing look of pity or contempt, left it as it was. The latter may perhaps compared to meteors which beautify the night, while Nib and the class to which he belongs may be said to resemble the sun which cheers and animates the day. Happily for our race, for one who possesses the loftier qualities, there are 1,000 who possess the more useful, and the example of Nib will have exhibited in vain if we do not at once suggest and encourage imitation. To God, the giver of all good, be the glory of what was, what he was, and of what he has accomplished. So closes Hinton. Thank you. We have, with that very question, we proposed to have a Baptist historian symposium dealing with that exact question. We've planned it to meet in Philadelphia in the year 2007,
which is the 300th anniversary of the Philadelphia Baptist Association. And in that symposium will be made up, the steering committee is made up of Baptists from every group we could get together. We met at William Jewell College last August, and it was unbelievable. As a matter of fact, Stanford Merle is here and would represent the Sovereign Grace Baptist Association. But I think, Stanford, you'll admit, it was amazing to see Baptists of every persuasion coming together in a calm, considerate Christian manner and dealing with something that's very important. Why is there such a lack of interest in Baptist history amongst Baptist people? We had there Landmark Baptist, Seventh-day Baptist, Primitive Baptist, Reformed Baptist, Southern Baptist, American Baptist, ABA, BMA, Seventh-day Baptist, German Baptist, Swedish Baptist. I know I'm leaving some out, but it was amazing. And they agreed to form a steering committee, and we're going to meet again this August in Philadelphia to continue that on toward a Baptist historian symposium that will deal with the question, why is there such a lack of interest amongst Baptist history by Baptist people today? I can't answer it yet. I hope to in 7 years, or in 2007.
Could ask another question. We could ask another question, but we probably know the answer. And one of the things would be, is how can we help to promote an interest in Baptist history? And one of the things that you as a congregation could do would be to help sponsor a book. And I happen to know that they have a whole list of books that they'd like to publish and would publish if they had the finances. So that can be done.